This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has a new book that collects his broadcast commentaries and the columns he's written for the New York Times. Jeff is a senior researcher at the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University and chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. He says that his new book isn't really for language buffs. It's not about the way the language is going to hell in a handbasket. The book is about what language can tell us about our culture and our changing ideas and sensibilities. It's called Going Nuclear: Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. And yes, I'm not accidentally mispronouncing the title. The title is Going Nuclear. I'll let Jeff explain why.
That's the title of one of the pieces in the book about George Bush's pronunciation of nuclear as nuclear. And it struck me as standing in for a lot of the ways people think about the language and the way Bush uses it in particular. I had listened to it. Everybody thinks it's just a kind of mistake born of ignorance. But the more I thought about it, the more it struck me that in Bush's mouth, it was probably less merely a mistake and more a kind of choice. I call it a faux bubba pronunciation.
I'm wondering if you think you can hear the so-called culture wars reflected in the way America is speaking. If you hear divisions and how people on different sides of the political spectrum speak.
Well, there are different kinds of divisions. I mean, obviously, there are going to be divisions in the way people talk about the particular issues that have been in the fore in the culture wars. So whether you describe a certain position as being pro-life or anti-abortion rights or pro-choice or anti-life, I guess, depends obviously what position you take on that issue. But in another sense, I think it goes even deeper than that. I think there are differences in tone between the left and the right that run a lot deeper than that. You know, I was listening a couple of years ago to a right-wing, kind of an angry white guy radio station, because I can be an angry white guy at times, too. And I noticed that the host of those stations are always using C, like, see, the Democrats really don't want to tell you that such and such, or see, those people really don't want to work. We're on left-wing radio stations like Pacifica or on NPR. People don't say see, they say look. And that's an important difference, that look is the word you use when you're trying to persuade somebody of something. See's the word you use when you're trying to clue somebody in on something. It struck me that it really was suggestive of two very different mentalities that are associated with those two sides.
Were you saying that NPR is left-wing?
No, I said.
Or, you use the word
left-wing
or.
Stations, okay. or NPR.
Okay, just checking. Have you been listening to the language of the presidential campaign and how President Bush and John Kerry have been speaking?
Yeah, I don't think it's really gotten going yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it'll emerge in a couple of months, but there are already some clear differences. I mean, one thing was very striking during the Democratic primaries was that for the first time in many years, the Democrats were not reluctant to talk about words, use words like moral and values and so on. Kerry was saying that the U.S. has a broken value system. Howard Dean was saying we've lost our moral compass. John Edwards was using that kind of language. And that, I think, reflects an interesting shift, even as the Republicans have either taken over or tried to neutralize a lot of the language of the left. The Democrats have moved in and are trying to neutralize or reassert their ownership of a lot of that language of values and families and so on.
Jeff, I'm just kind of curious. We often get feedback to the pieces you've done on Fresh Air, but I'm wondering, you get feedback directly, too. Of the pieces that you've done for us, what's been the most controversial? What's gotten the biggest response?
Well, the one piece that's gotten by far the biggest response was a piece I did back in, I think, 2001 on Bernard Goldberg's book, Bias, which claimed that a sign that the media had a liberal bias was the fact that they always identify conservatives as conservatives, but they never identify liberals as liberals. And he just kind of asserted this without any evidence. So I thought, well, this is something we can check. We can do counts nowadays. So I went to a bunch of major newspapers and set up this rather elaborate procedure for doing the counts. And I discovered, well, no, as it happens, major newspapers identify liberals as liberals about 35% more often than they identify conservatives as conservatives. I got enormous amounts of mail on that piece, and it was picked up by CNN and other stations and became a controversial matter, and other people did other counts and so on. So I'd have to say that because it got into that particular controversy about bias, it was the piece that received the most mail by far.
Now, I think it's so interesting that there are these computerized search engines that you can use now to research things like this that you would have never been able to research before, at least not as quickly and easily.
No, you know, it's completely changed the way people think about lexicography and language. The Oxford English Dictionary, when it appeared, contained a total of, I think, about 1,800,000 citations for all the words to demonstrate the meanings of the words that were collected over a period of 30 or 35 years by all of these volunteer readers who sat there writing out little slips, which were then sent into Oxford and assembled in the little shed in the back of Sir James Murray's garden. And nowadays, I can do a Google search or a Nexus search and find 1,000,000 citations for a single word, like insane, in the course of a couple of seconds. So that's one way that they can be interesting. Another thing we can do is we can count things, which you couldn't do before. You can look to see if a word's becoming more popular or less popular. I did a piece for Fresh Air on the word royal. Phyllis Myers, the producer, called me and said, well, what's with this word royal? How come I keep seeing it? R-O-I-L, I mean. And I said, gee, I don't know. And I went to the newspaper databases, and I looked. And sure enough, that word had become 10 times as common in newspapers as it was 20 years ago. Now, it's a favorite word of headline writers because it's only 4 letters long and, you know, 2 of them are skinny. But it's just a word that suddenly became more frequent for some reason. Sometimes that's more interesting, the word. I went and looked to see how people have described Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth over the decades. And it turns out that they're about 3 times as likely now to be described as legends as opposed to heroes as they were 20 years ago. And that's a sign of how this word legend is taking the place of hero in the lexicon. You can look at a phrase like class warfare, for example, and watch it spike whenever the Democrats start to criticize Republican tax proposals. So in those ways, you can really discover enormous numbers of things about the ways words are used.
So with the help of search engines, are you doing a different kind of linguistic analysis than you used to? Are you looking for things that you didn't look for before?
Oh, yeah. I'm always trying to figure out ways now to make a point statistically, just in terms of some little almost statistical anecdote that drives home a point that otherwise wouldn't be clear. Not long ago, I went to the New York Times and the Washington Post. And I did a search on the phrases liberal values and conservative values. And it turned out that even in those supposedly liberal papers, conservative values was something like 3 or 4 times as frequent as liberal values was, which is really a sign of how we think of that word values, that it belongs to the right and doesn't belong to the left. And that's a point it would be hard to make if you didn't have that little statistical anecdote to go on.
We've been talking about language that has some kind of political charge to it. You've done a lot of pieces that have absolutely nothing to do with that. One of the most popular pieces that you did for Fresh Air was on the use of the word like and how that has changed. And like is a word that so many people find irritating. And you had such interesting things to say about it. I'm going to ask you to just, like, recap a couple of ways that you think the word like has changed from the way it was first used by hipsters in the 50s.
I think we owe the hipsters either the responsibility or the blame for a lot of the words that have been most important over the last 50 years. Like cool is a word that came out of the hipsters. And so is like in an interesting way. I mean, it was used by the hipsters as a way of distancing themselves from what they were saying. And it was picked up by a bunch of disc jockeys like Wolfman Jack and High Lit, the Philadelphia disc jockey. It passed into teenage slang with the help of that Bob Denver character, the Maynard G. Krebs beatnik character in The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis. And it entered teenage slang sometime in the 60s, at which point it instantly became, for most observers an index of the general degeneration of the teenage mind and attention and of everything that was wrong in America, as if they themselves had spoken perfect grammatical English when they were in their teens. But it did a lot of work in teenage language at that time. It was a way of distancing yourself from a request, for example. You'd say, could I, like, borrow your sweater? Which was a little more polite in some way than saying, could I borrow your sweater? And then sometime around the 80s, it became what we linguists call a quotative, as in, so I was like, you've got to be kidding. Moon Unit Zappa helped that one along a lot, and it became associated with Valley Girl slang. Spread very rapidly and once again was denounced as the most terrible thing that had happened to the English language since the Norman invasion. It's interesting because when you listen to the way teenagers use that, either in its kind of weakening sense or in this quotative sense, it has a real purpose. What struck me about this was that I was thinking about the word, and I was listening to the news reports of a school shooting down near San Diego a couple of years ago. They were interviewing all these students about what had happened. The students were clearly shaken up and disturbed by it. They weren't particularly articulate. They were saying, you know, and so on and so forth. They didn't say like. None of those teenagers said like in describing what had happened. And that's because like is a word that conveys a certain ironic distance from what you're talking about. And when the circumstances don't call for ironic distance, they just turn it off. It isn't just a mindless tick, in other words. It has a meaning. It's used when it's appropriate. It isn't used when it isn't appropriate.
In your new book, Going Nuclear, you have collected pieces from Fresh Air, the New York Times, and other places you've written for. And you also write a little bit about the fact that you've written for blogs. And, you know, you mentioned that the style for each of these is different. And I'd be really interested in hearing about the difference in how you write, say, for a newspaper and how you write for our show. Now, I know Phyllis, who produces your commentaries for Fresh Air, is probably always trying to encourage you to write in short, straightforward sentences because the ear finds it easier to follow sentences that are like that, where there's no grammatical complications, there's no, like, inversions, there's not a lot of separate clauses. But, of course, in a newspaper, you don't have to worry about that kind of thing. So can you talk a little bit about what it's been like for you to write for both mediums?
Well, writing certainly for Fresh Air and for radio in general, there are all these little grammatical tricks that you're talking about. You write these very short declarative sentences. You avoid using relative clauses. You don't ever make lists of more than three items. That's a rule that Phyllis told me early on when I started doing these, and I found is a very good rule to bear in mind. And the other things, I mean, the fact is that when you're doing a radio piece, as you know, you're coming to the end of the piece and you want your listeners to know that the piece is about to end, so you have to have this kind of summary little quippy sentence at the end to say, okay, now the piece is about to end, now we're coming to the end, now here's a little quip to tell you that the piece is over, because you don't have a little box at the end of the article in the page. So there are a lot of differences like that. Of course, writing for the New York Times has its own quirks and whatever. I mean, everybody's Mr., you know, Mr. Sting, Ms. Cher, and so on. You have to give these full identifications of everybody, and you have to write in this slight. I have a lot of trouble writing for the Times in a lively way. I think it's like the font, right? Anything that shows up in that font is gonna sound like that.
You dedicate your book, Going Nuclear, to your father, who you describe as a lover of words. In what sense was he that?
Well, he was someone who took language very seriously, who was scrupulous, even fastidious, about getting the rules right. I recall once somebody used the word fulsome in a way that just meant copious or abundant. He said, no, fulsome means treacly or sickening or excessive. In that sense, it doesn't mean that, and held his finger up in the air. That was really very characteristic of second-generation immigrants, particularly Jewish immigrants of his generation, who felt that in some way mastering the language was a way of creating a kind of entitlement to American culture. One of the things that's very striking is how many of the language mavens, and note that word mavens, are in fact Jews of of that generation, Theodore Bernstein and John Simon and Edwin Newman and William Safire and so forth, all of whom inherited in some sense that affection and fastidiousness about English usage.
How do you see your work compared to theirs?
Well, in a certain sense, I inherited that from my dad, too. I took it to excess or whatever when I became a linguist. And at that point, you begin to think of language not just in terms of a set of little rules of correctness and so on, but as this deeper, more complex structure that really a lifetime of study will not get you to the heart of. And at that point, you begin to think of language differently. You begin to think not just of trying to get the rules right and so on, but understand why the rules are the rules and what the language is trying to tell us. And at some point, listening to language becomes a way of finding out other things. You know, the words that most people find interesting when they hear you're a linguist, they say, oh, I'm interested in that. The words like serendipitous or antimacassar or things like that, where what makes linguists linguists, or linguists are the ones who think that a really interesting word is like the. And so linguistics is into the battle for the long haul. But I'm not actually that interested in words as such. If you find yourself thinking about a word and it doesn't take you somewhere outside of language, then it's usually not that interesting. Where what's interesting is the way words can betray attitudes, social changes, ways of thinking about the world that would otherwise be really hard to get at.
In your role as a father, have you ever been in conflict with your role as a linguist? In other words, hearing your daughter talk as she grows up, is there a conflict in you between wanting to correct her as a father to make sure she speaks well and properly and all that, and an interest in just standing back and listening? Because that's what you do as in your role as a linguist. You listen and observe and then try to figure out what it means.
Yeah, for a long time I said, I'm not going to correct my daughter. She'll come to the right forms, in due time. And I'm really more interested in listening to what she has to say and trying to understand it. Because I think to a certain extent, if you're always trying to correct, you're not really going to be listening to what's going on. And I had this very strong belief till, I guess, about 4 or 5 years ago when she started to have writing assignments. I would have to go over them with her. And at that point, all bets were off. No, Sophie, you put a comma before a non-restrictive clause and so on. And at that point, I began to correct her. But I still don't correct her, I think, in the way my father would have corrected me.
Which was?
She might dispute that. But
how would he correct
well,
you?
Well, my sense is that what do I know? This is the correct rule. Sooner or later, she'll learn it. If she doesn't learn it, maybe it wasn't that important a rule to begin with. So I kind of let it go. I certainly don't, when she, these old bugbears, when she says hopefully, or she uses anxious to mean eager and things like that. I mean, everybody does that, and who cares? I certainly don't correct her when she uses like, as in, so I was like, you got to be kidding, and so on. Because that's just part of the language she speaks. It would be absurd for me to correct that.
Well, Jeff, a pleasure to talk with you.
Great to talk to you, Terry.
And take care.
Thank you. And thank you for having me on.
And congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Jeff Nunberg's new book is called Going Nuclear: Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times.